Life of Illusion by the great Joe Walsh, who seems to have his finger on the pulse of the issues we're discussing tonight with my guest, Jules Erbach, one of the pioneers of virtual reality technology. It's an exciting time. I mean, the pace of change is so exciting. There was a release that came out a couple of days ago that Jules put out about a new venture, what he calls a first step into a larger world. And when I say that he's a major player in this technology, his partners in this are Disney and Marvel and ESPN and ABC. I'm going to ask him about that partnership and then open up the phone lines. Your questions and comments, I know you've got to have a million of them, because I still have a million of them. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So we've been hearing from Jules about just this amazing transformation, the technological leaps that are being made, the possibilities of virtual technology, virtual reality, and it's just exciting. Jules, I swear I wish I could be around for the next 50 years, because it's going to be such a transformational time, assuming we don't blow ourselves up or something. I think what's daunting for people of my generation is the pace of the change. You know, you grew up with this kind of technology, gaming and things of that sort. It's still new to me, and I am a little bit of a Luddite, but it is exciting and also daunting at the same time. I think you probably understand what I mean.
I do. You know, I also am starting to feel that, because to me, the change that's happening isn't linear. It feels exponential.
Yeah.
You know, it took 10 years for the iPhone to appear and then get to this point, and it's going to take probably half that time from today for VR to be in the position the iPhone is today. I mean, I don't think you have to wait 50 years. I think in 2021, you're going to have amazing VR at commodity prices that anyone can afford. And that's, you know, that pace is crazy. You know, it's even for us, even though I live and breathe this work, it's a lot of change. It's a good thing in the sense that I think that it does bring a lot of things much sooner than the decades it might normally take, but it is, you know, the pace is blistering.
I saw the release the other day about Disney and Marvel. What's that about? What do you got going?
So our work, you know, in VR has been, I mean, because VR is still nascent, you know, it's been about building the tools and letting others, you know, essentially tap into this emerging device form factor. And we've been working closely with Facebook and Oculus, which is the subsidiary that does the VR devices, to bring them photos and bring them these experiences. And Disney's an investor, as is HBO and Discovery and others. And the opportunity we had was with social in VR, which is very compelling to me, because I don't think that the experiences that I'm most interested in are the ones that are singular. It's more about sharing what you're doing in VR with others. And, of course, Facebook, billion and a half people, I guess, on that social network, they're certainly interested in getting these group experiences going. So when Disney invested in this and all the different things that were on the table, one of the things that I sort of proposed to them was, let's, with this launch of our work with Facebook on Oculus Social, let's actually get all your websites, you know, working as virtual spaces. When you type in Disney.com, you go somewhere physical, you know, in VR that does feel like it's a physical location. And you guys can help us, you know, we'll help you with the technology, but you guys can design that and treat it like a web page. And, you know, the early days of the web, you know, the web pages were very simple. You didn't have video. You didn't have all the interactivity you have today, or apps, right, that you could download from the site. So with Disney, they, for example, we have a virtual Disneyland that when you go to Disney.com and you see a sort of holographic overlay of the actual Disney website, but it's just floating there, and you're really in the middle of a virtual Disneyland, and there's, you know, statue of Walt and Mickey, and, you know, Marvel is something similar. You're in that universe, that world. So it's really interesting to sort of redefine how going, you know, the experience of going to a website like Disney.com or ESPN.com works in virtual reality. And the first step is just creating a space where, you know, the web page is still there, it's still extant, but you have an environment around you. And of course, it's like the web. You can keep adding to it, you can keep changing it, and it's a very important piece towards what people call the metaverse, where you know, right now we sort of have an abstract universe of information, web pages and things like that, but it doesn't feel like it's, you know, the same as our physical reality. The metaverse is meant to be these sort of spaces that people visit and potentially maybe one day live in. And the start of that is to take things that are from the real world and connect them to, you know, brands and experiences that we would imagine being relevant. And Disneyland is like one of these things that makes a lot of sense. With Discovery, I think the focus will be with them more on doing the same sort of thing for real world locations, and with partners like HBO. I mean, you know, the idea is that things like Westeros from Game of Thrones, the opening of Westworld, I think I might have mentioned, was done in our software. We can take a lot of these kinds of shows and build spatial layers around them that you can visit. And with Facebook's help, we actually now have it so that when you visit with your Facebook friends, you see them in there, and you can all sort of participate in, you know, in what's going on. So currently, with what we launched with Disney, one person who starts up the, you know, who visits the page first or visits that site first controls what is going on in that floating Disney viewport. But others can see that, and eventually we'll add other controls, and you'll see right now a floating head of your friends. They can pick their avatar, but it's, you know, two or three steps away. Facebook is adding the ability to have customizable, more realistic-looking avatars, and eventually you'll have something that is much more representative of your full physical body in these experiences. But the framework of that is really starting now, and it was great to get Disney on board because it does provide a lot of traction for, you know, getting all this started even this year.
It's exciting. I mean, you could go to the Shire and hang out with hobbits. You could go you could be on the Starship Enterprise. You could go back in time, be there for the signing of the Declaration of Independence or something equivalent to Westworld. You know, and I haven't even touched on this, but sex. This is, you know, it's a family program, so I don't want to get too detailed, but I mean, it has been a driving factor in technology, video cameras and VHS and DVD. I'm sure that is somebody's thought of that possibility.
Yeah, I think we're beyond the thought part of it. I mean, it's a running joke with people in the VR space that, like, VR porn is really huge. You know, people buy our software and probably, you know, use it like they would anything else to do productions, but it's already huge, and it's, you know, I people have written a lot of articles about it. It definitely is, you know, I haven't tried it, so I can only tell you what the people who have this described it. They do say it's more compelling than video. So I, you know, or a website. So I feel like, yeah, it's probably going to be a big part of adopting and driving the technology. I think that's just the reality of virtual.
Yeah, the time travel thing really would appeal to me. That would be pretty cool to go back and see certain events in history.
I agree. And I think that what's fascinating about that is there's a very good chance that we'll be able to make that very compelling very soon, because we're creating totally imaginary worlds out of whole cloth that look real, you know, the Star Wars worlds and we did do the Starship Enterprise. One of the things we launched along with Disney in partnership with my friend Rod Roddenberry was the original 1966 Starship Enterprise, and in the view screen you have StarTrek.com, you have the Roddenberry website, you can watch all the old episodes on the bridge of the Enterprise, and it's awesome with your friends. We could recreate, you know, things, certainly when there's an existing physical location, it gets easier to recreate the Great Pyramids of Egypt as they were back in the day. Declaration of Independence, again, interesting. You can, there's life casts of Lincoln, so in photos you can almost have him, you can almost imagine trying to get the Gettysburg Address, these living photographs. It's going to be very compelling, and we're very close to getting those kinds of things up and running, both in terms of things that are from the past and even present, and possibly, you know, again, I think rather than saying, well, like, what's the future going to look like, let's go visit that in VR, you'll have every possibility that is far beyond anything that we could physically create for a long time to come available as these experiences in virtual reality as well, and that could be interesting too.
Yeah, you could put yourself in movies. You could be with Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca or...
Yeah. Absolutely. What's compelling about this is, and I think this is something that appeals to the average person, is that anything you can imagine that's compelling as an experience that seems hard to do with the limits of current technology is going to be much, much, much simpler, not just to experience, but also to create. And that's also where AI comes in. I do see AI being a really helpful tool to fill in the gaps. So if you have an idea and you want to be in a, you know, it will help you, Bogart. The AI will basically look it up, figure out how to build that for you. And that is very much the Star Trek holodeck. You tell it what you want, and it kind of, you know, I want to be at the Declaration of Independence signing. It'll figure out who was there. It'll look up the scans of the various, you know, photos or, sorry, I should say paintings of people that were there and try to rebuild and reconstruct it. And AI will be very good at that. And I think that's what's going to make a lot of these experiences seem really magical is, you know, just like it's kind of crazy to do a Google search and you get back all this relevant information, you know, you're several steps away from having the ability to just sort of think about a scene you want or describe it to the computer, and it'll help build that for you. And it won't necessarily require a lot of the manual work that is currently in place to do that.
Well, I look forward to that. I struggle with Siri, and I'm sure that it's a lot of the problem is on my end and how I describe things. I'm sure that there's got to be AI that's more advanced than that in somebody's hands. Maybe you've worked on something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned, so AI is something that I, and especially in the use case I just described, is really important to this process because I imagine that, you know, and AI, of course, is going to change a lot of things in this world. I mean, you know, the president just did an interview, or sorry, he was a guest editor of Wired, and he described in pretty impressive detail, like, sort of his views on policy around jobs being lost and AI taking over for things. So it's very clear that even at the very top of the hierarchy of government, there is a really deep awareness of how important AI is going to be. I worked on a natural language parser, which is essentially what, you know, you use to sort of try to have a computer understand what you're saying contextually and then give you back a response. And it was a really interesting area of research. I had a lot of ideas that I wanted to implement, and it was hard to focus on that as a product and do rendering at the same time, you know, all the graphic stuff we did. So I focused on the graphics piece. But at some point, you know, I feel like I want to get back to that, the work on AI. And I almost feel like a lot of the work we did with graphics couldn't have happened 15 years ago in the same way that it is now. Like the computers, graphics cards, all these things had to get to a certain threshold where it became really easy for us to render cheaply things that looked real. And AI is very similar, and it's going very quickly towards the point where there'll be a lot of infrastructure, both in terms of hardware and chips, to revisit a lot of the hard problems that AI failed at in the past and do it much, much, much better. And I think that one of the areas of AI that I've always been really, you know, interested in is the ability for AI to sort of understand the context of what's being asked of it and give you back a result that is important to you. And I got something working that was pretty good. It was very much like Siri, but this was 2008, so it was a while back. And it was done as sort of a, you know, I put a pin in it, and I want to revisit that because I think that once we're done building sort of the manual tools for people to very simply create beautiful things and pull in, you know, anything they want to sort of make these scenes look real, to make this something that is available in the hands of everyone, I think the next step is you describe, you know, for audio, even just talking to the to the glasses or the headset or the cloud, what you want to see, what you want to do, and it could even be very complex stuff. You know, I want to work on a level on top of our tools that is able to translate that and do a lot of that labor sort of automatically. From sort of beyond that point is when you do have that kind of interaction, this augmentation of our existing, you know, will with AI, it does point to what I think is going to be, you know, a really important step for civilization, where you can essentially, with an AI almost as a second voice in your head, start to, you know, contribute and deal with life. Because even our bodies the way they are now, there's things that we do out of reflexes. I mean, it's. I think they've done many experiments where they, you know, you can see your body reacting to things. Your hand does some moves and does something to block a, you know, something that might happen and to hurt you before your mind is even fully aware of it consciously. And I think that does show you that the very seat of consciousness or ourselves, you know, our identities don't necessarily need to have every single thing the internal. I mean, it could be that AI really does help extend that. And then going back to the question of whether AI independently of a human consciousness could be alive and real and whatnot. I mean, I do think that by having AI watch what we do and work with us, at some point you might get a suitable enough training set for it to actually act just like a human independently of us. And, you know, philosophically, we'll have to determine whether that is identical to us as humans, but I certainly think that the rights of an AI and artificial entities are going to come up, you know, in the not too distant future when you have you know, years of an artificial intelligence's experience and a, you know, continuity of self-awareness. you know, you might want to protect that. You may need to do something.
I want to ask you, we'll take a call, but I want to come back maybe a little bit and ask you about Skynet. And I don't mean to be a downer on this whole thing because
it's
very exciting.
I love this kind of stuff. So.
Okay. All right. Wildcard line, Mark in Baltimore. Hi, Mark. Good morning. You're on with Jules.
Hi, how are you? Thank you very much for taking my telephone call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
In terms of virtual reality and the goggles that you described and the holodeck and everything on Star Trek, is there going to come a point in the near future where we're going to be able to put these goggles on and utilizing existing film footage and still pictures and everything from, say, the Hubble Space Telescope and the footage the astronauts took from walking on the moon? Will we be able to wear these virtual reality goggles and be able to go to those environments?
How far away is a consumer product, Jules?
Well, you can go to Best Buy today and try the first versions of those, and they're pretty compelling. And you do have things where you can see Mars as filmed by the Curiosity rover in VR, and I would suggest that if there's an interest in that, VR is now mainstream enough, you know, where it is now in Best Buy, it is now in, you know, it's sold in stores, and even in its early form, if you're interested in having these kinds of experiences, and the ones you described are all really compelling, it's there today. It's just going to get better from here on out. But we're definitely, I think, at the point now where you can almost call it like the iPhone 1, when, you know, 10 years ago when that first came out. A lot of the rough pieces of smartphones that we have today were already in place there, and we just improved the quality over time. So the Samsung Gear VR is particularly a good VR device, and without even having to buy one, you can certainly go to stores like Best Buy and try it out. And I think that I would recommend that and see if that's something that you feel is compelling. But it's not years out. It's right now. This year is the year of virtual reality. It's pretty exciting.
Thanks, Mark. And do you need, the Samsung VR system? Do you need a Samsung phone or is a PlayStation, or what do you hook it up to?
The cheapest and most accessible VR is the phone-based virtual reality. There's already at least a million of these devices out there because Facebook released the numbers that people spend about 25 minutes average, a million different people with the Samsung device. That's already a lot of users. And if you have any of the Samsung phones going back to the Note 4, there's a very cheap adapter that Samsung at one point was giving it away for free that will take your Samsung phone and turn it into a VR device. Google actually has an even cheaper version of this that you can use to take your iPhone or any other phone, and it'll give you a similar experience. But the Samsung one is really the best one that's out there currently in terms of quality.
So Google has something that you adapt that would work for and hook it up to an iPhone or any phone.
Yeah, and we've just announced a partnership with Mattel where this will work with your iPhone. They have a new version of the ViewMaster that will take any phone, including your iPhone, and they even sell it at the Apple Store, and you can experience virtual reality with this very inexpensive ViewMaster device. And we just did a project with them for Batman where, you know, it's going to ship, I think, in a couple of weeks, and it'll allow you to use your existing phone with the ViewMaster toy. And that's how mainstream VR is getting. So it is really possible to experience this with any phone that you already have, and with a very inexpensive adapter that's typically made out of plastic and has a couple of other sensors on it.
We're going to go to a break in about 30 seconds. Tell me this, not you don't want to discourage people from trying it now, but how quickly will the technology advance? In a year, is there going to be a big difference between what I can buy now and what...
The biggest difference is when you get one of these VR phones, for example, you can look around and your head is tracked perfectly. I mean, it really is compelling. But if you walk, you don't move through the scene. So a year from now, I can guarantee you that almost all of these phone-based VR systems will have the ability to track you as you're moving, and that will be a really big step forward for VR. That is pretty important.
All right. We're talking with Jules Urbach about the potential of virtual reality technology. We'll go back to the phones in just a bit here on Coast to Coast AM. Wow, this show has just flown by. My head is bursting. It's exciting stuff. Technological changes. It's not in the future. It's here, and it's incredibly exciting. I promise we have one segment remaining. I promise I'll be quiet, and we'll get to the phone lines because they're full. I'm A lot of folks with questions and comments. We'll get to as many of them as we can with my guest, Jules Urbach, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Our final segment, we go east of the Rockies, Barry in South Carolina. Hi, Barry. Good morning. Thanks for your patience. What's on your mind?
Hello, George. What a pleasure to speak to you again. I am telling you, buddy, what a show tonight. I wish it had 3 more hours. And, Jules, are you sure you're not from the future? You sound like you're living in 2030. I mean, you've come back from the future, and you're telling us things that are going to happen 15 years from now. Does that make sense? I'm telling you.
My mind definitely lives in a different time than the present. You know, I mean, as I was describing earlier on this show, you know, a lot of these ideas and just seeing a lot of these things happen decades ago for me, and I'm still waiting for a lot of things to happen. But to be honest, these VR goggles that are, as I said, now in Best Buy, it's amazing, because a lot of the ideas that I was percolating in my head decades ago about how we could be rendering reality, the bets I was making on technology, are finally sort of coming to fruition now. And, you know, I think that, 5, 10, 15 years from now, the trajectory is fairly clear in terms of how compelling and realistic this will get. I do say that you know, in the, you know, beyond that, it's hard to predict because of how society will react to having these kinds of this kind of power. And I think that, you know, it would have been hard to predict, even knowing that the iPhone was coming and the internet was going to be as widespread as it was, the kinds of things that were built on top of that collectively. So there are things that I'm excited to still see happen, and I'm very certain about, but I'm also, you know, like everyone else, I'm just going to wait to see how it all sort of plays out. And it's I think the future is bright and very much going to be a richer experience for all of us, I believe.
Barry, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. And it's always good to hear from you. West of the Rockies, Jennifer in Portland. Good morning, Jennifer.
Thank you for taking my call. Jules, I've very much appreciated everything you've said. And I have an interesting question, and it's multi-layered, but I'm going to ask it very simply. Do you think that VR is an excuse or
substitute?
Yes, thank you, for God. Because it really makes people think that they are God.
Well, I you know, I think that's a question that every individual have to come to, you know, decide for themselves. I think that VR in its ultimate form possibly is one of these transformative experiences where miracles won't seem that crazy when you can make them all happen in your personal space, in your personal life, and you might be able to share that with others. But, you know, I think that if you're looking to what is the meaning of life and what is the compelling first cause of existence, VR might help us understand, you know, what that isn't better. But I do think that you know, you're still going to be asking the same questions, and people will still have spiritual feelings and thoughts above and beyond the experiences that you can have through VR. But I do think that some things that you might confuse for, that are almost metaphysical in terms of nature and, you know, in terms of, well, do you really have to wait for the afterlife to have an experience that is just like the afterlife described in every ancient religion? No, you could probably recreate that in VR just as easily as some of these other things. I do think that there is a lot of questioning that might happen around our ultimate identity and our roles when we're so easily blended in a world that isn't constrained by the physical. And a lot of, you know, thinking about, you know, spiritual and religious themes, and God included, is all about what is in the world beyond, what is abstract and above this reality that we're locked into. And VR will definitely help us think more along those lines and answer those questions maybe in a more, in a different way than we've ever been able to before as a society.
Thanks, Jennifer. I'm not going to delay you from answering other callers, but you could make comparisons to out-of-body experiences, which some people can do, near-death experiences, which some people have described. It's very similar to the kinds of things that you're describing achieved technologically. We'll go to first-time caller Tom in Savannah. Hi, Tom.
Yes, great show. I really, really like the subject, George. Jules, I have a question concerning the technology involved in making a worldwide hologram using clouds and satellites to set up a hologram that could be seen worldwide by everybody at one time.
I'm sorry, what was the question specifically?
I think he's asking if it's possible to create a worldwide hologram. I mean, or eventually could, maybe for, are you suggesting some, go ahead.
Using satellites, could you possibly broadcast a worldwide hologram seen by everyone at one time?
Well, I can tell you there's a shortcut to making that happen, which is, let's say 30 years from now, everyone has not glasses or goggles, but contact lenses that are, that's literally how you experience the world, and everyone sees things through that. It wouldn't be that crazy to imagine somebody hacking, you know, billions of people's experiences digitally, just like you can hack things now, and broadcasting something that is literally beamed into their eyes. That's what makes this the technology so exciting and dangerous. I mean, as far as beaming a physically free-floating hologram that is, you know, opaque and it looks like it's real, the technology to do that is very far off, because it's difficult to pull that off. Even some of the more compelling things that I was thinking about for the holodeck, like just building a wall that looks like it's you're looking at a hologram. I mean, it takes a lot of technology that is still in the early stages, and doing something where you're beaming a free-form holographic object that feels real is, you know, it's definitely one of the further things out there. And I think that the effect might actually come sooner, because I do think that you're not that far off from the contact lens replacing the goggles as sort of the main interface for this. And at that point, they'll be literally glued to people's eyes for a good chunk of their daytime waking hours. And at that, yeah, if you hack into that and you decide what you want to beam into people's vision, that could be, you know, that could give you that effect. So those are those sort of the two ways I look at that in answer to that question.
Thanks for the call. We're going to go to the wild card line, Shira in Sacramento. Good morning.
Hi, Shira.
Shira, okay,
Jules.
Sorry.
Okay, thank you, Jules. Jules, first of all, I want to commend you on following your ambition, that thing that you got obsessed with when you were a kid on the Santa Monica Pier, and turning this into an industry-altering just amazement, and something that I'm sure has provided well for you, and where you can provide for yourself and your family. That is just really cool, and so you should be very proud of yourself, first of all.
Thank you.
I had a question about when I first started hearing about virtual reality in the early 90s, and hearing about it, and it was going to be the next new thing, and then kind of afterthought, and it might work with this thing they're working on called the World Wide Web, I don't know, whatever. And then the internet kind of explodes, and I think more so than anyone ever saw coming. And then it seemed to me like VR got really pushed into the background. And what I wanted to ask you was it really pushed into the background, or were people such as yourself and others really just working on these things all this time? And why has it kind of taken so long to get back into an area where it would be used in the public, such as the new VR goggles? And I had one more quick question about if you ever think it will get to the point where we will have neural implants.
Good questions. I'll start with the first one. First of all, VR did get pushed to the side of the 90s. People in the industry and working in VR talk about it, we laugh about some of the early 90s experiences. It's a lot like, you know, smell-o-vision or 3D TV, which didn't really quite take off. I mean, it wasn't ready, and the reason why it wasn't ready was that it was too bulky, it wasn't polished, we didn't have the technology to do it right. And so this is really VR 2.0, the stuff that's happening right now. And I would say that it wasn't even ready 3 or 4 years ago. You know, Google Glass was kind of that same play, and it was, again, I was describing that this, you know, the experience was too small, it wasn't thought out enough. But the big change that's happened is really the fact that cell phones have become so small and the screens have become so good, it has made the current, you know, generation of VR displays really compelling and possible. And so the cell phone revolution, the miniaturization of displays has given VR, I mean, the experience of VR was always something people understood could be really compelling, but it's made that practical, and it's also made it something that you can imagine and can imagine now being in the hands of millions of people, and soon tens of millions, and then hundreds of millions, and so on. And I think that it's really the last 2 years that's become possible on top of the cell phone technology that we've had in the last generation or two of phones. You know, and I think that the
neural implants.
Neural implants, yeah. So, yeah, I think that that is, you know, there's people that are already putting RFID chips into their, you know, into their wrists and things like that. I mean, it's, I think that when you have physical trauma that you know, where that sort of thing would actually be important, you know, to your quality of life, you'll see that put into practice, and I think you can already see basic, you know, connections from your senses to a digital computer through, you know, hearing implants. And I think there's even a case where, you know, sight has been restored, at least in black and white and in low resolution digitally. And it is just a matter of time before that gets really good, and then you'll have that option. And I think it'll be a choice. I don't think it'll be a mandatory experience, but I do think some of the other senses that beyond sight and sound, there might be people that, again, I mean, if you're looking for to sort of short circuit the decades of work that might allow that to happen in a more natural way, implants might actually be the, you know, the first step towards that. I would imagine that at some point you could do that non-invasively. And I also feel that, you know, my preference optimistically is that there's even better experiences that you can have without even going there.
So virtual reality for the visually impaired. No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really exciting. We're going to go to wild card line two, Perry in Santa Barbara. Hi, Perry.
Hey, thank you, George, so much. I always enjoy Sunday nights with you, and this is mind-blowing, too, to me.
Yeah, all
and
of us.
Jules, oh, man, you are good. You are really good.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir. You know, it's unlimited. We could see the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show in color.
Yeah. You know, what's funny about that very point is that AI is not good enough to do, you know, remember the old Turner recoloring those movies? Like, you know, it was done by hand every frame.
Yeah.
You know, computer algorithms are not good enough to actually add color and understand what the color should be. Yeah. Automatically. And so the next step is, like, let's bring that out into three dimensions. Let's map the Ed Sullivan Show broadcast to the Beatles' faces. And yeah, you're probably in the next decade, you'll start to see that really, you know, if you want to go back into archives of photos or paintings or anything that's collective in the collective imagery of pop culture, you can start to extract really good representations of that into VR. And that is going to be exciting. There's a lot
of a holographic Beatles concert or Elvis or something like that.
Elvis, yeah. And my questions, guys?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah. How close, you know, are we to, you know, on Star Trek Voyager especially, to actually, they use a technology called force fields and photons. And how close are we to that where we can actually, like, shake somebody's hand or whatever? I prefer sex in the real reality. But how close are we to that? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you both so much.
Welcome. Well, I think the question of touch, you know, everyone that's in the VR space, I mean, we're all very focused now on getting the obvious senses figured out, like sight, which I think is going to be pretty well solved in you know, the next few years, to the point where it looks really good. Audio is already pretty well done. There's a company working on 3D, you know, basically smells, which could be almost done like a printer with different, you know, by mixing different primaries.
Huh.
Touch is harder because it's obviously to be able to touch something in physical space means you have to do something in that space. So the first approach has been to actually have like the equivalent of a glove where it vibrates and gives you a sensory feedback mechanism. Others have looked at doing compressed air, which gives you, again, a similar thing without any sort of device on you. And I guess in the far, you know, further down, which is definitely in sort of the longer term, you might be able to have something like utility fog or digital clay, which will be able to generate shapes and things that you can touch. And then, of course, there's the brain interface, which could just, you know, fill your brain with the sensation of touching things. There are things called there are sex toys that already plug into the internet and give you those kinds of things. They're very crude, but it you know, again, obviously there's a lot of interest from people around that. So that's already an industry. But in terms of general physical sensations, you know, that what I was laying out before is probably the path towards that. And I think it'll be pretty compelling with having, especially when your fingers, most of your senses for touch are really in your face and in your fingertips. And if you have something that is already attached to your face and you have something on your fingertips that vibrates and it kind of almost compresses or makes it harder to squeeze things, that's going to give you a lot of the sensations of touch that you might want in a VR experience in the early days. And from there, it might get more sophisticated as the hardware improves and the physics around what we can do improve for those last set of senses.
Try to get one more call in. I think we'll go to Dean in Portland. Maybe we can get more than one. Dean, what's on your mind?
Well, I was wondering what your guest thought of the Roddenberry X Prize that was just won, which is kind of the reverse of what you guys are talking about. You put on the haptic suit and the goggles and the gloves and control an actual physical robot. That,
well, yeah, I think
world and. And you can go send them into a Fukushima type situation or a burning building, or you can rent a robot to go shopping for your grandma in across the country and make her dinner.
Huh. Yeah. Well, what's interesting about your question is that it actually, to me, it's not the opposite or inverse. It's one of the extensive things that VR will offer. So when you have a drone, like a Parrot drone, and you turn it on, you can see a video of what it's doing on your iPhone, and you can actually control it. So extending that towards, like, well, you're wearing a pair of VR goggles, and the robot that instead of having a drone, maybe it is a drone, maybe it is something that you can see in VR. I believe there's already drones that have a VR goggle app or something that they can give you that experience, but certainly one of the things I would say is if you're going to have somebody's experience fully in VR, there's nothing stopping you from actually having a physical robot avatar in the real world that is able to do things for you and interact with the real world as if your virtual avatar would in the virtual one. And robotics are getting really good. That's an area of advancement that is getting very compelling. So I think they're just different parts of the same same framework, and you're right in the sense that you can be in a virtual experience that is driving a physical robot far away, and if somebody ever figures out how to send information faster than light, then you could probably send robotic space avatars to any part of the universe and control them and get real-time feedback. But of course the speed limit of light makes the latency very hard frankly, beyond the Earth. So that's one of these things that I think about it a lot, actually.
That's the quantum stuff should get around that, shouldn't it?
Yeah, I was just looking at an article on quantum entanglement and trying to figure out whether there's definitely some sort of connection.
Spooky connection.
Yeah, I would say that in terms of like the physics that we know might work is if you create a wormhole, and if you can just send one bit of information through it, forget a spaceship, forget a person, you might be able to then establish really long communication lines that have zero latency between different points in the universe. And so the question is, if that is theoretically possible, that would get around the faster than light communication issue. It's more likely you could send information than a physical object. And that might be enough, and it's going to be interesting to see whether that is how this all ends up happening. But, there is definitely some sort of option maybe through that path that is not requiring new science to imagine a way of communicating faster than light between
people. Well, I'm guessing that in a year you'll be ready to come back and talk about that because you probably will have solved that problem by now. Jules Erbach, it's been tremendous, man. It's a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. I hope you'll come back. And I hope it's been worthwhile. And I hope that people will check out your website. We've got the links on our site.
Absolutely.
I hope you enjoyed
George, it. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
All right. We'll see you again. We'll talk to you again, I hope. Also, thanks to my earlier guest, Tony Hendra, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Nathan Staten, Donna Walker, Greg Bishop, our webmaster, and Den Galante, and Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next Sunday night. Good night, everyone.